Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight in this difficult night in Sydney traffic. Thanks for getting here. Mike Baird makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him very briefly because he's well known to all of you. Mike Baird is MLA for Manly and has been since 2007, or as he said tonight, he's looked across this magnificent view. He said, that's my Manly over there, so that's Mr. Baird's Manly over there. And of course, he held senior positions in opposition, and since 2011, Mr. Baird has been the Treasurer. And before going into politics, he had a very successful and significant career in banking. So he's one of these politicians who gave up a very promising career outside of politics to come into politics. And tonight, Mike Baird's going to talk for us on the topic, Trust in Politics, Who Cares? Mike Baird, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Jared, and thank you, everyone, for coming along. And no, that's not my Manly, that's my community, of which I'm very proud to be a part of, Jared. But it does look beautiful. I did think when I was in banking, I used to come up here, I used to think this is an incredible place. And then I thought very quickly about what it was doing to my legal fees of my clients. what a topic. It's a topic that I thought a little bit about. In terms of what can I come and talk to the Institute about that's not necessarily part of the run-of-the-mill. How does it sort of connect into what we're doing and what is happening in politics today? And is it relevant? And when you get a chance to get a helicopter view, as I thought more and more about this topic, I actually realised how significant it is. And I don't think we've done enough to actually focus upon it. So trust in politics, who cares? My argument, hopefully, at the end is everyone. I'll let you make up your mind. So in simple terms, I just want to ask, you know, what is the level of trust in politics more broadly? Why is it important? What can support or corrode it? And importantly, how we can restore it. And there's a bit of a roadmap, I think, on how we can do that and obviously be interested in your questions and thoughts as we go on it. So in terms of the basic premise of do voters trust politicians, I think it's not going to surprise you, my view is not many do. Monash University recently did some research, and I found this quite fascinating. About 6,000 responses they looked at, and they found that trust in politicians had hit a new low. And it found that only 27% of people thought the federal government could be trusted almost always or most of the time. And that, when you think about it, governments as an institution should be one that I would think sits much higher on any scale that you put forward. I mean, who are the institutions you trust? But at 27%, it doesn't rate well. Back in the mid-2000s, it was actually about 48%. So, you know, there was a position that it's almost halved in a relatively short time. Asked whom they trusted, voters ranked political parties below real estate agents, trade unions, employers and TV news programs. And it did get me to pull out my favourite Reader's Digest survey. I know that's quite not up to the standard, Jared, in terms of the Sydney Institute, but it's quite funny. When you look at who are the most trusted professions for 2013, it's not going to surprise you who's at the top. I mean, the firefighters, paramedics, nurses, I mean, you'd expect that. You get down at about 27, you get down to alternative health practitioners. My former career does make a list, but it's down at 35. So bankers, all the bankers that are in the room, well done, 35. Interestingly, 37 is airport baggage handlers. I don't know how they got there. But they're one above clergy. So they've done well. Sex workers coming at 46. Insurance salespeople come in at 48. Politicians 49. So we've made the top 50. Who is 50th? If there are any door-to-door salespeople here, I am sorry. But you are number 50. So the long and short of that is that it's very clear in a broad perception, whether it be a survey such as that or indeed some of the work that Monash University has got, politicians aren't really trusted as a general profession. And, you know, does that matter? Well, Mark, the instinct and my natural response is, well of course it does. You know, if you're part of a profession, you want to have trust. And why is trust important? And I think that as you get to it, it really matters because it matters in relationships. You know, if you don't have trust in a relationship, you don't have much of a relationship. And when you break politics down, it after all is all about relationships. It's a government with its voters. It's an MP with its constituents. It's community groups represented by individual people making individual decisions on their thought and relationships with the government and the MP. So it is all about relationships. And London School of Economics has done, I think, the perfect analysis on why I think this is important. And they use UK and US researchers. And what they addressed in a paper, which was 2 months ago, they said this. They said, listen, a certain amount of distrust in governments is actually a desirable thing in a democracy, since the willingness of ordinary citizens to monitor their governments is an essential part of the democratic process. However, when mistrust of politicians and governments becomes endemic, the concern is that this will make governing much more difficult. Now, citizens who comprehensively mistrust their governments are unlikely to give their consent to essential policies. Such distrust is likely to have other effects as well, such as weakening tax compliance, even undermining the norms which underpin the rule of law. So a reservoir of citizen trust is an important requirement for a healthy democracy. And I guess that's, you know, my concern. When you look at the trend on where government was, you know, back down at 27%, it's all going one way. And what does that mean in the broad politic if we continue to erode that trust? So clearly, and I believe that, you're unlikely to have the capacity to deliver your essential policies if you don't have that trust. So how do you restore it? You know, what do I see as the foundations, if you like, of trust? And I've got 5 points that I want to talk through. The first is the consistency in actions. And I think the key example here, and this is not to be political in any way, shape or form, I do square the ledger as we go. But when you do look at the former, the simple premise, you know, are you doing in government what you said you would do in opposition? And that's the basic sort of trust contract that you give to the community. And if you ask me, you know, what is the reason that Julia Gillard lost both the prime ministership and struggled in the polls, it undoubtedly came from that moment when, you know, she said there would be no carbon tax. And take the politics out of it, I'm just looking at the statement of the context. And it was explicit and it was clear and it was definitely not going to happen. So the moment that appears in government, we now are going to have one. Well, that is a platform that anyone in the community starts to think, and it was ruthlessly exploited, obviously, by the federal opposition. How can we trust any words that come when that basic... We've seen that they said one thing and they're doing another. And that is the erosion. So I think trying to be consistent in your actions is critical. Maurice Yemmer, I think, suffered a similar fate here in New South Wales when he said before an election that they would not sell electricity, and they spent a big part of 4 years actually trying to sell electricity. Now, that is something that does not work. I think on the other side, I think that John Howard, when work choices appeared, you know, that wasn't something that was a platform. You know, that was something that appeared within government and well beyond, if you like, the trust that had been built up between him as Prime Minister and the community. We could talk more about that, but I certainly think he overshot his mandate as part of that, and that was viewed by the community as a breach of the trust that had been built up. You know, I also think, though, that on the contrary, I mean, John Key in New Zealand, I think, is a very interesting example to look at. His work, he terms it, I think, wonderfully pragmatic conservatism. He does things in a steady way that brings the community with him. He said before his first election that he wouldn't be selling assets, and he didn't. But he outlined a plan for the second election of this is what we'd be doing, and he sold 49%. I think it was Meridian Energy. And at the same time, the community, having worked with him, and I believe he embedded the trust. In fact, I wasn't able to get the actual statistics in New Zealand on the level of trust. I think, intuitively, I'd say it'd be quite high in a New Zealand context. And similarly, I think, John Howard, in relation to the GST, it was an example of being upfront. This is what we're going to do. He argued on many street corners for many days. Birthday cakes aside, it went from one part of the country to the other with a clear explanation on why this is good for the country. And I think there were opponents, but the fact that he was prepared to go to an election on a policy which is not easy to convince everyone that a new tax is a good thing. I think the basis that he laid the platform, delivered it in government, that trust was maintained on the way through. So, and I think that Barry O'Farrell has done the same thing for us here in New South Wales. He made a commitment not to sell poles and wires in the lead up to the last election, and I can tell you in terms of the finances and the opportunities that provides, they are significant. But he has purposely and determinedly said, unless we have a mandate, I've said that we won't do it, so we won't. And I think that goes a long way towards restoring a trust with the community. I think he's done that well. The second foundation is consistency in policy and values. And this is a tricky one. And it really is. And the best example I could think of was actually the current Prime Minister. And I'm sure he won't mind me telling the story. One of the more difficult days that I've had in politics, I got a call from him, and he reminded me of this particular story. And it was all about the Commonwealth Bank. Just before the 96 election, the finances were in trouble. Labor was looking for opportunities to sell assets to sustain their financial position. And Tony grabbed the Prime Minister, or the opposition leader at that time, and said, listen, we have to block it. We have to oppose this. Their finances are in trouble. This is a fantastic opportunity to cause trouble for the opposition. So what he said, John Howard, in response, said, no, Tony, we will be supporting it. You need to ensure that we follow good policies, good principles, and the politics will take care of itself. And so as they won, they did support it in opposition. When they won government, obviously they continued the process. But I think that is a very clear mark of someone that understands the need to trust in the community. To do something on one side of the election, to oppose, and then to do something differently, I think erodes the trust significantly. I think it was a very good example. There are clearly, though, I'd say on this, shades of grey. There are shades of grey. Economic shocks come. And those economic shocks might mean that you really have to redraw, what are the priorities, what you need to do, and what are some things you can't do. But in an overall principled approach, I think trying to be consistent day in, day out, regardless of what is going on daily in the political cycle, what challenges you're facing, being consistent with your policy and your values will hold you in good stead. And I think the community would recognise that. It's also important, when state governments are trying to hang on to their credit ratings, they look like anyone else at the management and at the business and at the results. I remember in banking seeing very regularly new proposals with what we call the hockey stick forecasts. So there was these beautiful opportunities coming, great streams of revenue and profits. And you thought, that's what you're telling us, but what happens if you don't actually achieve that? When we start to taper them down and put in some scenarios around it. It's the same thing with the rating agencies. They look at the quality of your projections and they ask you to deliver against them. So they don't really look forward, they look back. and really any single banker will tell you, and the rating agencies do, that you are the best predictor of future performance is past performance. And if you're delivering what you say you are doing, then they will have much more trust in the forecast you have. So in a broad stakeholder engagement, trust has many applications. I certainly think it's one thing that I've grappled with in this job. We want to make sure that as we're putting forward what we're going to do financially, we deliver it against it. Because the moment we don't, is the moment you start to lose the rating agencies. The third principle is, I think, is being prepared to invest in some long-termism. And this is a challenge for politicians. You know, the challenge is on a daily basis is to deal with the opportunity before you. You know, what are we doing today? What is the media opportunity this week? You know, what is the crisis that we need to put out? How do we deal with that? When is the benefit going to start flowing through? And the natural inclination of any political cycle is to like to see results as quickly as possible, because that's the way the cycle works. If they're seeing that you're doing things, well, then you've got an opportunity as a government to be recognised for your achievements. What loses traction in those variables and those decision-makings is the long term. And there's two things I think that we're doing that I think is important. Social benefit bonds, some might be aware of them, some might not be aware of them. It is something that could easily not gain a priority in a budget context because the benefits flow back over 17 years. Indeed, really the first material benefits you start to see in 7 years' time. In simple terms, to describe it, it is a new opportunity to bring in additional capital and to tone in on outcomes. So when we've got two bonds running with kids at high risk, kids who are at high risk of being removed from their families. So if they're removed from their families, the likelihood is that they're going to be out for 6 years. When they're out, each year it costs $40,000 to government, let alone the impact in terms of literacy, numeracy, justice system, and also health. Now, from a policy point of view, we've encouraged investors to come in and share in some of those savings, should they be eventuated. In a normal group, about one in four would be restored back to their families. But what we are seeing, that the proposal we've got from Uniting Care, they believe that they can get two-thirds of the kids back to their families in a much earlier time frame. So that, if it eventuates, is going to deliver significant savings. Now, the problem with it, in a political context, is it'll be likely well beyond my time as Treasurer when you start to see the real benefits. But one of the things I'm incredibly excited about, because it is a different way of tackling some of the big problems. And everyone is focused in on the outcomes. Now, you have the NGOs working hard to ensure we're achieving what are the outcomes we're trying to achieve and putting the money towards it. We've attracted new investors. So from a state government point of view, we've got new investors helping tackle real social problems. And then there's unending applications. So where this goes, I think, is one of the real opportunities for this state in terms of social policy. And we've done the second and third in the world in the past 12 months. There's one done in the UK. And we're also looking at reoffending rates. You know, about half of everyone that leaves the juvenile justice system reoffends. Well, how can we reduce that? Because obviously it's the same sort of benefits. Now, in terms of the context of a political opportunity, the benefits aren't going to be there. But I think from a voter context, from a community context, if you're investing not just in today, but also providing consistent platforms for the long term, I believe that will shine through. I think it'll shine through. Because it is exactly the responsibility, I think, of the government to look only not only at today, but also tomorrow, but also new platforms, and be prepared to take risk for those platforms. Each budget that I brought down, I focused on something. One of the former treasurers, Michael Costa, actually, was very interested in this, and I credited him quite regularly. He would make a big point on what the budget did to the long-term fiscal gap. So the modelling that undertakes, well, look at all the services we have, the demands on those services, and our revenue, do we have the capacity to meet the changing demographic, the ageing population, the increased health costs? Do we have the capacity to meet it? And we have, in the three budgets we've done, had the capacity to actually reduce that fiscal gap. Now, really the only person interested in the media context about that was Imre, and Imre now works with me, so I've got no one to talk to about it. But I think that is an example. I think governments that are really looking, if you're looking at the long term and the challenges that are coming and preparing the state, or whatever sort of jurisdiction you are governing, you are looking for the long term interests as opposed to the challenge and temptation of the political interests. And I think that is really the challenge I put to all leaders, and I put myself in this. And listen, I'm not putting myself up, I should say that up front, as someone who is living and breathing this, there's much more I can do. It's a framework that for as much for myself to follow as for anyone else, so I want to be clear on that. And I also think that the other challenge in that is the infrastructure narrative in this state. There's a desperation for people to see things happening, to see cranes in the sky. Deanne said to me when I came in, we're seeing cranes in the sky. And that is a good thing. And I can assure you, my economic sense of this state is on the move. We're starting to see signs of this state really moving. But, to do it right, you have to plan, you have to get the money, you have to put everything in an orderly fashion. And if you don't do the hard work first, Muhammad Ali said, you can only dance up under the spotlights if you run on the asphalt. It's the same thing in infrastructure. You need to do the right priority, the right amount of work, secure the funds, and then get on and do it. And I think that we're about to see that here in New South Wales. The fourth foundation I have is really about having an honest conversation with voters. And I'm sure I'll be challenged on this, but it's my real sense. My real sense is that the community is crying out for this. They know there's challenges. They'll give us more slack than we realise on the challenges we face. What they want is just an honest assessment of what they are and what you're going to do to fix them, or what challenge they are facing and how are you going to go about attacking it. And the example I give on this is Newcastle. I'm not sure whether anyone's from Newcastle here, but if you stand in the middle of Newcastle, I generally believe it's one of the most exciting urban renewal opportunities that sits anywhere in this country, and across the Asia Pacific. You've got the most incredible beaches on one side, a beautiful harbour on the other, and you've got this train line that basically cuts the city in half. And if you take that out and put in light rail, the opportunity, and the university campus is moving down there, there's retail, there's commercial, there is so much opportunity to recreate some historic buildings. It'll be a beautiful, thriving city. Because of limited financial capacity, that this has been a thought. It's been a thought which that should be, shouldn't be, for 10, 20 years. It's been an ongoing debate up there. So, we told Newcastle, and indeed it was the centrepiece of the budget that we just said, listen, we want to do this, we will do it, and the connection that we make, we undertake a long-term lease of the port, we're going to take the proceeds that are required to do the urban renewal. So, collectively, it's close to $500 million. Required to make that happen. Now, that we had a scoping study last week that the lease is underway. But listen, even recruitment firms are now saying that that Newcastle is about to become this urban wonderland, that they are attracted by what is coming in Newcastle. I think the previous approach would be to announce a study, to think about it, to put out a sort of map. But if you have the discussion, listen, yes, theoretically you might not support doing something like a long-term lease, but if we do that, we are going to deliver this to the city. And, I'm obviously not popular in many parts of the state as treasurer, but I can tell you, going to Newcastle, it is overwhelmingly supported. On the ground, people are saying, okay, well, yes, we might have some misgivings about that, but we want to see this city revitalised. And that image, I think, is very powerful. I have heard as well, in relation to the WestConnex project, there was a debate about whether we include tolling or not. I mean, we had a debate about that within the context of our government. There was a debate at a federal government level, and it comes down to this. If you want the WestConnex project to be built, then we need tolls. It's the only way it's going to be funded. It is the only way. So if we tell the community that, then you have to be honest. If it's only going to build it, you have to be honest. And there is a significant benefit that comes. For those in Parramatta, I think it's 40 minutes from Parramatta to the airport. 50 traffic lights, I think, are avoided. 3,000 trucks put under road. I mean, there's an urban renewal project down Parramatta Road. It goes on and on. But I think, you know, you have to have that honest discussion. If you don't have that honest discussion, I think you end up in a place where things aren't done, things aren't achieved, and that trust with any community is eroded. Now, the last foundation I put in relates to the role of the media. And, you know, I was reticent to put this in, but I think it's actually totally and utterly relevant. And I think the media can play a critical role in both eroding trust, but also restoring it. And the example that I give, and you know, and I'm not saying that every story that government runs or every announcement needs to be followed in detail, but I'm just saying there are times and points where I think there's an obligation on media to report both sides. The example I give is the treatment. There was an Auditor General's report last year, and I could do a quick survey whether anyone remembers there were challenges in the financial accounts and financial reporting. Does anyone remember that in New South Wales as a broad thing? Yeah, the $1 billion that was kind of lost down the back of the couch. Yeah. You might have heard terms about tuck shops, might have made it through. So, I mean, there's a number of nods across the room in relation to that. But I guess the question, how many people here are aware what happened this year? Does anyone know? Not surprising, because there wasn't a line written about it. And I guess this is the point. We inherited financial management systems that were a challenge and needed to be invested. Any government goes through this, you know, either political persuasion. But you know, there was such colour and such activity and such focus on the failings of the financial management reporting system. All the words of the Auditor General, and he was colourful. Indeed, he left this year, and I actually gave him a tuck shop as my farewell present. Thanks. Good to see you. Hope I don't see you again. No, I didn't say that at all. Because fundamentally, I mean, he was right. He'd been talking about this problem for 10 years, and the media came in and focused on the year I was on watch, and fair enough. We had identified the problem and started to do work, but we still had much, much more to do. So the kicking was fine. I absolutely accept that should have been done. My challenge, because if you think again more broadly from a trust point of view, if the community is going, well, hang on, these guys have got financial systems that can't even add up. I mean, that would be almost the takeaway that you would have had from last year. Well, over the last 12 months, I can assure you, hundreds and hundreds of public servants have worked unbelievably hard to improve the systems, to improve the reporting, to improve the processes. And we've got to a position for the first time in 12 years, the accounts are completely unqualified. They've been qualified every year, sometimes a number of qualifications. The number of financial errors was not only significantly reduced, down to almost less than half what they were. There was no impact in relation to the budget whatsoever. It was just classifications in relation to the balance sheet and accounting. It was a truly significant step forward, and the Auditor General made a very strong point that this had been a very significant improvement in financial management reporting. Now, I'm not asking in any way, shape or form, for glowing reports, the pats on the back. I just have this sense, in terms of a trust, the community is left with one side. You know, why is the other one not there? I mean, you know, yes, page one led the news on a number of nights. Even at page 10, saying, oh, by the way, you know, looking at the report this year, you know, things have improved. And from a community point of view, I think that's helpful. And listen, that's just the nature, but I certainly think there is a role. You can't underestimate the role of media in maintaining that trust. So, it's not. I mean, I think, in conclusion, you know, ultimately of my time in politics of almost being in relationship. I think that's what you have to think of it as, you know, think of it in that way. You've got to ignore the regular sniping that comes in and think of your connection to voters or more broadly the community as any sort of relationship you hold dear. And that can kind of help to govern your approach and govern your actions. You've got to be consistent, and as I said, I think in your actions and your values. You've got to invest for the future and not just today. You have to be honest, as much as you possibly can, and hope that media, I guess, reflect both sides of the stories. And I think that package, gives an opportunity for politicians. It gives an opportunity for governments to restore something that I think is an all-time low in this state and in the country. And I think the investment is definitely worthwhile, because my strong belief, any government that maintains the trust will be going a long way towards maintaining government itself. So thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts, and I'm sure that people have some views, and I look forward to it. Thank you.
And we've had a very thoughtful presentation tonight, and I think it's a speech that will live on, because it's led us to reflect a bit on some of the big issues of the day without going trying to score political points as you wouldn't expect Mr. Baird to do. So we're very grateful for an interesting speech tonight. It'll be up on our podcast tomorrow, and I'll publish it in time in the Sydney papers online. And it's given us an opportunity to reflect on issues of broader issues, trust and related issues, before early next year we start reflecting on the state budget. So well done tonight, and good luck for next year.
Thanks, sir. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.